Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 23, delivered on November 13, 2018. The title of this lecture is Capital Budgeting.
Today, capital budgeting. Before we do that, a quick look at the markets will indicate that, as usual, here's something, of course, I might have already mentioned this, but, sir, whenever you get someone says, well, you're a finance person, or if they're from Decatur, a finance person, so you tell me what the stock market is going to do. And what you should say is, quite simply, it will fluctuate. Okay? You will not be wrong. And it will also shut them up. Unless they're really stupid, fluctuate, you say. How can I trade on that? Well, anyway, as you can see, the markets are generally slightly up today, and it's a broad-based but tepid rally, principally the result of fears settling down about interest rate increases by the Fed. That information has gotten through the system. And nothing dramatic has happened in world markets. So we're probably in a holding phase until the next exciting round comes through. The calm before the storm. Generally speaking, well, this is not always true, but historically, if you have a market crash, it generally happens after a great deal of volatility, but then the market settles down. It gets quiet, that calm before the storm sort of thing. Now, it looks like they've already taken down one article I was going to show you very quickly. Well, one way or the other, I'm not going to find it right now, but excuse me. Generally speaking, the markets are in a quiet phase right now. Does that mean that this is the quiet before the great storm? Probably not, although we will see it within the next, probably before the end of the month, I am projecting, but we don't know that for sure. Let me start with something. Madam, got a project. You invest $100 in me, and in 1 year, you're going to get $100 back. Sound like a good project?
No.
Why not?
I would like more money back if it's a successful project.
Oh, greedy, huh? I see. Okay. Well, yeah, that's the thing is that we would like to have a project return to us more than we invested, and by more, we mean usually in finance, well, always in finance, we mean more on a present value basis. Now, there are different ways that you can analyze projects in terms of whether or not they are a go or a no-go, but at the end of the day, in business, we cannot have subtlety and nuance in philosophical thinking. At the end of the day, we have to just say yes or no to a project. It's not something, well, let's kind of play around here a little bit, look a little deeper. That's not how business works. Yes or no, and we need decision-making processes that lead to a yes or a no, and not to some ambivalence and all that kind of stuff. We want to have an answer. And then later we can talk about why that answer might have been right or wrong in retrospect. But the one thing that you will need to know, and I wish that there was more emphasis on this in your business education, if you stick to best practices, you do things by the rules, by the book, then if you are wrong Anyone who comes to have dinner on your butt is going to have to come through a bunch of manuals that you can cite that say, this is how we do it. And if the answer comes out to, in retrospect, to be wrong, so what? We can do some lessons learned, see if there was some place we missed something. But that's why we have these rules and these best practices, and why I'm such a bitch in the classroom about doing things the right way and saying things the right way. Because at the end of the day, that's your cover. It's the old CYA, cover your ass. And it's not whether you're going to be right or wrong. You're going to be right more often than you're wrong. Don't let me mislead you on that. Doing things by the way they're properly done gets you right answers. This, well, let's think out of the box here. Well, first, you probably should know what's in the box, because what's in the box may actually be what you were going to spend a lot of time thinking out of the box about. Also, thinking out of the box, that's usually, you hear that in business from the people who are stupid as hell. Oh, let's think out of the box. That's because the box has a bunch of rocks in it that are smarter than you. Keep that in mind. So when I show you these methods, no, these aren't for all time. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show you one method that was for centuries the way it was done. We now know it is not the best way. As a matter of fact, it's not even the right way. But strangely enough, it's still being done to this day, this method that is not a good method. As a matter of fact, when I came fresh out of all my degrees and I was out there doing consulting with smaller corporations, starting to get into that, I had all these best practices. We'll find the net present value of the future expected cash flows of this project. And then I'd have these companies that were doing things by a method that we had actually been shown in class was a historical method that was absolutely ridiculous. And I was running into businesses that were using this method. And if you get into that kind of a situation where you know very well that there is something that should be done a different way, good luck with trying to change their mindset. Let me show you how it works. Okay, suppose that we have a project, and it's going to run us the year on the first column, and then the cash flow, or the expected cash flow. I be sure it's not actual, but it's what we expect. Okay, in year zero, we're going to have a cash outflow of $10,000. Year one, we're going to have the project will pick up and it will begin to pull in some money, $2,000 in. Year two, it's picking up steam pretty nicely. And in year three, it begins to slide away a little bit. Excuse me. $2,500. And year four, there is a residue of $400. And I'll throw in something here for you later. And the project has a salvage value at the end of positive $250. Little note about salvage value. I've said this before, and I will tell you again, and I can't emphasize this enough. A project that has no salvage value is a project that you know hasn't been thoroughly considered. Projects do have salvage value. There's stuff that can be sold off the end. There are also costs at the end of a project. Those are getting to be a real pain in the butt these days, especially environmental remediation costs. You have to close up a factory. You're probably going to have to do remediation on it. You got to get rid of a bunch of computer equipment. That could require a specialized kind of handling for the hazardous waste, because computers are a hazardous waste. All those things have to be taken into consideration. The pluses and the minuses. But at the end of the day, there should be a salvage value on a project. Oftentimes, it actually is positive. Not much, but it's there. Now, whenever you see a salvage value on a project, you always just put it at the end of the last year's cash flow. Always just put it at the end of the last year's cash flow. That's all you do. Well, we should have sold that equipment, but we never did. Well, then that means that you spent money, you lost money that you should have had. I've told you about that place downstairs. Do you remember I told you about a place downstairs, madam, in the basement of this building? That huge room that they're now going to turn into computer labs or classrooms or whatever. But it's down there and it's closed off. And in that room are all of these treasures. We're talking about things that you have never seen in your lives. From computers that have monitors that are 4-inch monitors, to floppy disk drives that are actually 8 inches and you hold them like this and you push them in, and to hard drives, a couple of those hard drives down there. They were awesome at their time. There's one I think that's down there. It's 10 megabytes. 10 megabytes. It ran about, $8,000 at the time. 10 megabytes. That is about 1/10 of the size of an SD card that you put into your smartphone. But man, that was rocked in the day. See, all that stuff was just put down there. When it was decommissioned, new computers were brought in, it was just put down there. It could have been sold. It could have been donated to charitable organizations, hell, to schools. There were schools that would have died to have those computers, even though they were a little outdated at the time. But we just stuffed it down there, and that's what a lot of companies do. I have seen literally fields of old equipment, especially down in Texas. I saw this. They just abandoned the equipment. They just put it in a field, and now it's sinking in, creating a nightmare environmental hazard that you guys are going to face in your lifetimes with all of these dumps, these car dumps that are so large you can't even see the end of the fields, all this equipment that's just abandoned. Yeah, that's toxic waste leaching into water, into aquifers and things like that. But anyway, ask if there's no salvage value, ask. Why isn't there a salvage value? And don't let them just kind of chuckle and push you aside. No, no, come back, sit down, and we'll work through why you didn't put a salvage value in there. Don't let people blow you off on numbers, because those numbers are going to be the decision makers with you about whether or not a project is go. So if you don't see a salvage value, you ask, why is there no salvage value? Okay. Now, this old, old method, matter of fact, the very first consulting gig I ever did, the CFO of the company, there was a CEO, a CFO, and then there was a treasurer and a secretary. The treasurer was the wife of the CEO, and the secretary was the wife of the CFO. It was a podunk mom-and-pop operation, but they were trying to do something a little bit bigger than they should have. And so they had projected these cash flows, and then they said, okay, let's sit down here. We've got some estimates, and we'll talk about that in a minute. We've got some estimates. So let's figure out whether this project's a go or a no-go. Let's set 3-year payback. Before I can even say anything, there they were with these pieces of paper writing down, okay, there is... $2,000 at the year one, $7,000 at year two, $9,500 at year three, and can't do the project, doesn't have a payback in 3 years. That was all it was. Oh, they just set an arbitrary time, the project must pay itself off within a certain number of years, otherwise the project is rejected. That's the payback method. It's completely wrong. It is absolutely ridiculous, but it was also the method of choice for centuries before there was an understanding of present values and the time value of cash flows. That's how it was done, and it is still being done. I think it was last year there was an article, and I wish I had saved it. I could probably go back and dig it up somewhere. It showed what method companies are using for decision making. Now, the two classics are net present value and internal rate of return. I'll show you those today. Easy, not hard. But then they put payback period, and there was a number, it was something like 48% of all companies are still using the payback period method. 40? Why is it wrong? Well, let me, by the way, put this on here, plus the 250. So total of 650 on year four on that. But why is the payback period method wrong? Well, first of all, it doesn't take into account the time value of money. These cash flows out here are not equivalent to each other, and they're not equivalent to the money that you've paid up front. Money deteriorates in value. It discounts as time goes on. This money, this $2,500 in year three, has no, you can't compare that to the negative $10,000. They are in different times, so they have no relationship to each other until you have discounted the $2,500 or compounded the $10,000. The other reason is a much, much more basic reason. Where did the 3 years come from? Why 3 years? Why not 2 years? Why not 5 years? Hell, why not infinity years? Why 3 years? No matter how many times I've seen this happen, when I ask why this number of years, well, that just seems reasonable to us. Or that's just the way we've always done it. That's just how it is. If you don't like it, you can consult for someone else. Cool, I will. And I'll short your damn stock, too, while I'm on my way out the door. See, the thing is that it just has no, there's no reason for it. It's just pulled out of the air, and then companies become embedded with this thought. This is the number of years. Every project must have pay itself off within this number of years. Sometimes I've seen 3 years was one. Very common was 5 years on projects. And then there were a few companies that said seven. And then there were companies that seemed to have two payback periods, one for very short projects and one for what would obviously be longer haul projects. But in the end, it's an invalid method. Why we still teach it? I used to ask that until I found out because you could very well run into a company that uses this method. That's all there is to it. Now, you need to write these down, these steps down. I'm going to show you the next method. But do it on a calculator. But before I do that, I do want to make a reference to cash flow projections. So we'll start with a problem. Cash flow projections. And net present value, cash flow and net present value. A project requiring an initial cash outlay of $50,000. Will generate revenue in year one of $10,000, in year two $15,000, in years three and four $12,000. And in year five, $5,000. with a salvage value. Of $500. If the cash flows are discounted at 5%, should you accept or reject the project? A couple of things here. First things first, the rate to discount. That's why we did all those things before, the capital asset pricing model, find an R sub S. Other methods we could use to figure out the weighted average cost of capital for the discount rate, the required rate of return, some method you will use to get a discount rate for the cash flows. The second thing, let me make the table here of the cash flows. Year, and I always do this just as a thing. Year cash flow, year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then we're going to kick 5,000, 50,000 out to start this thing off. Then we got 10 grand coming in the door. Then we're going to have a couple of better years, 12,000 on it. And then we got a tailing year here of 5,000. 15,000, yeah, I was going to say this project really sucks. 12,000, and then we got the tailing year in year 5 of 5,000 with the salvage value that you'll add in to make $5,500 in year 5. Here's where the first big problem comes in. The numbers themselves. Because the finance people are going to say, be suspicious. The accounting people are going to generally have worked with the marketing people to create a projected cash flow stream. And it would be the job of the finance people, who will be the decision maker at the end of the day, to say yes or no, but first say, are these numbers legit? Or are you trying to inflate the numbers to give us a false impression of the value of this project? Now, would that ever happen in the real world? Would people who have a vested interest in having a project go lie about the numbers that they were giving to us in finance? Oh, hell yeah. I'll tell you a really great example, and it's right here in town, and I think I mentioned this. I'm sure I mentioned this one. Have you ever been to downtown Bloomington? You ever been down there? We got a Coliseum down there. It sucks. It is a disaster. It is... Years ago, I was teaching at another place here in town, a private college. One of those places where the only people who are impressed by the college are those who graduate from it. Sort of like University of Illinois. That's right, I named you, but this one was here in town. I won't mention its name. Now, here's how it worked there. They had this whole thing at the time where students in their sophomore year or something, they would take a giant class that had some days a week that were marketing, some days a week that were management, some days a week that were finance. And it was weirdest-ass program. It didn't work, but what the hell. I was supposed to give A's to everyone anyway, so. The thing was that we had this wonderful opportunity at the time to have the lady who was then the mayor of Bloomington come and talk to all of our business students about this incredible vision she had of a downtown sports arena for Bloomington. It would be her legacy. She would bring with her the bankers in town, the old family bankers who were behind the project too. And they wanted us to bring our students to this big speech one night and have them do their presentation. Well, she was going to do the presentation. And the only person she brought with her was her city manager, a finance jockey. And so all the kids were assembled. These were the kind of kids who come to all the events dressed to the nines, looking really perky and smiling. And then, of course, they go home and get wasted and then come back to pretend that they're goody two-shoes the next day. But that's private school for you. Here's the deal, though. We were all, they had them lined up. And Judy, her name was, speaks about this grand Coliseum and showing all of these pictures of famous entertainers of that time, which had nothing to do with the arena. She was just showing pictures of famous people, giving the implication that they would be there at this venue when it was built. And then she brought her city manager up. Now, he was a very scrawny guy, and she had a leash on him. Come, boy, come, sit, talk to them, tell them how wonderful this project is. It was embarrassing. He gets up there, and he lays out the cash flows for it. First of all, his costs were wildly wrong. For one thing, I mean, during the question and answer, of course, no one had any questions, so I started needling. Where is the cost of the land? Oh, we own the land, so it's not a cost. Is that so? Have you ever heard of opportunity cost? Yeah. Well, what is? Well, do you understand that cost? That is a cost. Well, it is, but it isn't. Okay, let him go on this. The poor guy's beginning to melt. And then we went on with a few other things that were interesting. But then we got to this interesting part where he started talking about. I said, I need you to show how you got the cash flow pattern for this arena. This is obviously going to be driven by ticket sales. You've got ticket sales that are amazingly large here. Well, yeah, we're going to have a range of buyers in a 60-mile radius around Bloomington, Illinois. Who am I kidding? Around Bloomington, Illinois. 60 miles. What's within 60 miles of Bloomington? Well, Peoria, yeah. And you know what else is within 60 miles of Bloomington besides Peoria? Nothing but corn and cows and Ma and Pa Kettle. Yeah, let's go see Snoop Dogg tonight. I always did want to see him, yeah. He sure knows how something about corn rowing and all that. Yeah. And yeah, you're going to have, wow, we'll have rappers there. Oh, yeah, we're going to have a bunch of white cracker boys who drive their giant oversized trucks going thump a thump a mofo. They're going to go to this and they're going to run into real gangsters from Chicago. Oh, I want to put bets on that one, yeah. 60 miles, my butt. They're not going to, it didn't work. They projected cash flows that were so ridiculously high. You know what's happening to the arena right now? It has this color of ink that they just buy in gallons for the financials. It's red. And, of course, you know what's happening. It's just like all these other sucker cities that do this kind of stuff. They get the idiots to over-project revenues, under-project costs, and then the real backers in Chicago, L.A., New York, Boston, San Diego, they just sit back, wait 10 years, and then we'll buy it for pennies on the dollar when they finally have destroyed their finances of their city. That's the way stadiums work. They let the private promoters stay way in the background, let the thing get hyped up, public money is spent on it. Then after about 10 years of negative cash flows, because it is a freaking disaster, they sell it for pennies on the dollar to the buyers from the big cities that will then turn it into something worthwhile. That's how it works. As P.T. Barnum said, there's a sucker born every minute, and there's two people around, probably from L.A., Chicago, or New York, to take advantage of it. So they got creamed on that project. Cash flow, question cash flow. Ask hard questions. Where did you get these numbers? Well, we use a focus group. A focus group? Really? Oh, that was what? Eight people you asked if they liked the product and they pay $1 million for it, and they probably said yes because you gave them a free sample of it? Sure. Be cynical. Not quite as cynical as I am. Even my cats don't like me unless I hang a pork chop around my neck. But anyway, turn on your TI. Write these steps down. Bring your calculator with you on Thursday, and we'll just crank a few of these out then. But I'll show you how ridiculously easy this is. Okay, we used to do this by hand, and this one is bad enough, but the next one I'll show you, which this calculator can do in a couple of seconds, it would literally take hours to do. One problem, but watch this. Okay, apps, finance. Now, this time we go down to 7, NPV. You can toggle down and hit enter, or you can just type 7. And it brings you back to the front screen, and now you see NPV open parenthesis. The first thing you're going to do is put in the discount rate. Now, every time you want to put in another piece of information, at a minimum, a TI-83 or 84 wants a comma. And then you're going to put in the negative cash flow with a negative sign, not a minus, a negative. Negative $50,000. Now again, as I said, whenever a TI is, whenever you want a TI to see a number as new information, you give a comma as the signal. Now, in this case, TIs want you to put positive cash flow in braces. That is shift parenthesis. In braces, shift parenthesis. And then you pump in, year by year, the numbers. Now, if there's a year that is not there, just as if you had zero for it, yeah. I'm just testing to see if you're watching what I'm doing there. See, that was good. 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 I want you caught that. Open braces. Now, put in the stupid number 10,000, comma. Another piece of information. So a comma goes in. And then 15,000. Comma, 12,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 5,500. Now you close the braces. You're selling the calculator. We're done with the positive cash flows, and now we can close the parenthesis and say enter. Ouch! Negative $2,322.
$5,000.
Reject the project. Reject the project. It's a negative. Even if it's negative a dollar, negative 2 cents, reject. Just negative. This goes back to what I said before. We need a place where all the discussions come down to a binary, a yes or a no. In this case, it's a no. And all the fussing and crying and bitching in the world is not going to change. Oh, wait, well, we got some new cash flow information here. Let's bring that to you tomorrow. No, we're done. Don't try that on me. Now that you know that I'm using net present value analysis, don't go around me and try to inflate your numbers to save your butt in this project. It's no. Now, that sounds harsh, okay? That's business, okay? Or, if you come from the South, that's business. You got to put the D in business sometimes, make yourself sound authoritative. Yeah, that's business for you. Okay, that's it. Don't play with these numbers, okay? And don't let them play. It's yes or no. In this case, it's no. Now come back to me with something new, because I'm bored. Okay, so that's all there is to it. Now, if you had to do this by hand, what you'd have to do is you'd have to take $10,000 discounted back one period at 5%, plus $15,000 discounted back two periods at 10% at 5%, plus $12,000 discounted back three periods at 5%, plus $12,000. You'd have to do that whole thing and then subtract the $50,000 to get a number. That's how you do it with a calculator but without the app. And if you didn't have the calculator or the app, you'd have to do this with the tables that they had you use in accounting. And personally, I'm not going to live long enough to use tables to do a problem like this. And also, more realistically, Excel, and that's what I'll do on Thursday, is I'll show you how you can do these cash flow analyses in Excel. Because once you've got real problems underway, it's just a matter of getting the net present value of some complex, the numbers are going to be different every year. Every year is going to look like a different set. These simple numbers aren't going to be the numbers you'll be using. Just put it into a vector in Excel and say equals NPV, blah, blah, blah. And then boom, it's all done for you. Let me do something here. I'm going to look at 4% discount rate. At a 4% discount rate, by the way, did you see how I did that? Let me make sure you know that you can always say second enter, and that'll bring your formula back up onto the screen for editing. Whatever you did. That can be a joy when you've made a mistake and you can just, instead of keying in a big, huge thing again, you can pull up. Now, the one thing you have to watch out for is that in original mode, in the edit, you can go anywhere, and if you type in a number, it will overwrite the number that you just typed that you had there. In order to add a number, you have to hit second insert to get that, to get it to do that. But look at what happened. That was 5%. At 4%, the NPV was negative 107.07. At 3%, magic happens. And again, I'm going to edit. Second enter. See the formula come back up? And then I just toggle back up to where I want to be. and I move over to the 4. Now, I just want to replace the 4 with a 3, so I won't hit second insert. I'll just type in the 3, and it will replace the 4. And then I hit enter. Well, spank me. At 3%, it's a positive net present value project. 2.35.57. The project goes positive at 3%. Somewhere between 3% and 4%, this project drops from a positive net present value down to a negative net present value. Now, that is normal. That is what happens. As you lower the discount rate, the NPV will rise. Was there a flash over there? What the hell was that? You know, I told you, when I have flashes at my age, it's a small stroke starting, and, you know. No. Anyway, okay. Let me do this here. Let me show you something. This is the, on this axis, discount rate used, okay? On this axis, the net present value will go like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1. And then down here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I suck at this anyway. Done. 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 3, 4, 5. Okay, now, discount rate of 1%, 2%, 3%, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. Anyway. Here's what the graph shows. Okay, at 5%, the net present value was negative 2,000, 5, 10, 15, 20, about down here at 5%. It was way down here with a negative net present value project. Negative is all get out. At 4%, it was still negative, but not as negative. But at 3%, it was just slightly positive. Right about here. That's an NPV function. Look, the NPV always starts out positive, and then it goes negative. As your discount rate increases, the net present value of the project falls. Now, every project will have its own NPV line, but that's how it works. Now, here's the interesting thing, and this is a terrible graph. See this place right here where it crossed the axis from positive to negative NPV? We have a name for that. That's called the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project zero. Now, back in the day, to get this, you would literally have to start with like 5%. Okay, it's negative there, so let's back down to 2%. Okay, it's positive there. Let's go back up to 4%. Let's go back. And you would actually have to do what's called an iterative process, just recalculating the NPV for different interest rates. Now, we don't have to do that anymore. The internal rate of return is one of your calculator buttons. And I'm going to do it the hard way first. Well, actually, I'm going to show you the easy way. I'm going to show you the easy way. Okay. See that NPV function? We actually have another fun. Well, I'll just do it the hard way first, and then I'll show you how you can do it easily. But okay, apps. I'll have to show you the hard way first. Finance. Now, toggling down to 8, you'll see the internal rate of return. Here it comes. Now, with the internal rate of return, all you do is put in the negative cash flow, comma, then you open the braces, and then you pump in your positive cash flows. 10 grand, 15 grand, comma, 15 grand, comma, 12,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 5,500. Close the braces, close the parentheses, and then smoke that thing. 3.18%. Look how fast. I'll tell you, to this day, it just blows me away. After doing one of those, it can take you hours. Just do a discount rate that's too high, discount rate that's too low. Go back and forth until you get a discount rate accurate to 2 decimal places. In this case, it's right there. That was actually not a bad call. Graph. The internal rate of return is 3.18%. 3.18%. That's all there was to it. Not hard at all. And again, bring your calculators or computers on Thursday. We'll go through some of these, and then I'll show you how to do it in Excel. The value for Excel, obviously, is that you can do large amounts of data, big data analyses. The advantage to knowing how to do it on one of these calculators is just simply that if you're doing a quick, dirty calculation, you know, back of the envelope, well, let me turn on my computer and boot up Windows. Oh, we got an update. We're going to have to wait for that. No, you could just pull out your calculator. You can get an answer very quickly. But now, very quickly on this one. Okay. Now I'm going to bring up something interesting, okay. Remember I told you, what are the decision-making methods? Okay, the payback period method is, of course, it's there, very popular, unfortunately. Net present value is strong, and the more we produce of you modern business thinkers, scholars, you're bringing that in, and it's slowly pushing away the payback period method. It's probably going to take another, in your lifetime, it's probably until 20 more years, 30 more, before we get almost all of the residuals of the old methods out. But NPV is popular. But interestingly enough, internal rate of return is really popular, but for the wrong reason, unfortunately. Now, the internal rate of return on its own really doesn't tell you anything. It's just a number. Well, that's a discount rate where the project goes from being a positive yes to a negative no. Well, what does that mean? Well, it actually has a couple of big uses to us. Suppose, for example, that it is Thursday. It's Thursday. And you, madam, have just gotten the preliminary information for deciding on whether a project is a go or a no-go. Okay? So, we gave you the information. Now, we didn't tell you a discount rate to use. So you can't do a net present value. We didn't tell you a discount rate. We'll get that to you tomorrow. Okay? But here's the cash flow. Here's the cash flow. Okay, I could get an internal rate of return. You gave me the cash flow, I could get an IRR for it. Right? Just put in the negative, comma, put in the positives, and I got an internal rate of return. Well, suppose that you came up with the internal rate of return was, let's say, 6.27%. You got it. Well, that doesn't really help you. But then I come back the next day. Okay, we got your discount rate for you. The discount rate for this project that you use for your calculations, I want you to use 8%. You should be able to tell me instantly yes or no. Don't even do the calculation. That's exactly right. No, because I gave her a discount rate that was larger than the internal rate of return, so the project would have to be negative at that discount rate. That's how powerful the internal rate of return is. Again, she found that this internal rate of return informed her that this project went from positive to negative at 6.27%. That's what internal rate of return tells you. It doesn't tell you anything else. It just tells you where the thing goes from positive to negative. So when I came in and I said, okay, future executive, I want you to use a discount rate of 8% on this project, you don't even need to do the calculation. You know that that was above IRR, so you know that the project's NPV function was negative there. Any discount rate above 6.27% would be a no. But if I had come in and I said, my bad, it's 5%. What's yes or no? You'd say yes, because it's at 5%, it hasn't crossed that axis yet. So you're all good. That's how fast you can do this. It's fast and dirty. You can do it. That's why, even when I've done consulting, although I use NPV, I will quickly, when I see the cash flows from a project, before I even bother to worry about discount rates, I just rapidly just go in and get my internal rate of return. And if it's a bunch of projects, just get it for all of them. There are two problems, internal rate of return. One is there's a misuse of it. A company will actually use internal rate of return backwards. Now, this can be confusing as heck if you don't think of it as completely backward to what you should do with an IRR. Many companies, and I've run into this much more frequently than NPV analytics, they'll use what's called a hurdle rate. They will set a hurdle rate for all projects. All projects must meet this return on investment, this ROI, this internal rate of return. And if a project doesn't, then we reject that project. They create this hurdle rate. Sometimes I've asked, there were a couple of examples, situations. I said, well, where did you get that hurdle rate? And they did not know. They'd used it for so long that it was no longer in the life knowledge of the people who were in the finance department at the time where the hurdle rate had originally been established. But they'll set the hurdle rate. And let me show you the logic of it. The corporate hurdle rate, let's say, is 10%. So any project that has an IRR above 10% is accept. Any project with an IRR below 10% is a reject. That's how a hurdle rate works in a company. The company sets a percentage and then says, all right, all projects we accept, the only projects we accept are those that have an internal rate of return above this. So let's say that you have project A, B, C, and D. And their respective internal rates of return are 9.4%, 12.8%, 7.3%, and let's say 15.0%. By this logic, you would accept B and D and reject A and C. Putting it on a graph, 1, 2, 2, 3, 4, 5%, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15%. Okay, now watch. Project A, 9.4%. Okay, well, let me do this. I'm going to put in the hurdle rate as a big black dot right there. That's the hurdle rate. Now, Project A, the only thing I know about the shape of that internal rate of that net present value line is that it crosses the axis here at 9.4%. That's Project A. Do you see that at the hurdle rate, it's negative net present value? Project B, whatever else I don't know about this line, I do know that it crosses the x-axis at 12.8%. That's Project B. So at 10%, it's still positive NPV. And then it's Project C, is a 7.3, that's a goner. That thing is very negative at 10%. And then the last one, Project D, that's a big time winner. It's very positive down there at 10%. That's the logic. But again, the way the rule works is, all you have to say is, well, here's your hurdle rate. Find the internal rate of return. If it's better than the hurdle rate, yes. If it's less than the hurdle rate, no. Problem one with this method. Same with payback period. Where does this number come from? I saw companies, and I've seen one recently that was using a hurdle rate that had not changed in probably 20 years. I mean, the interest rate environment goes up and down and up, and these companies don't change their hurdle rate. They just let it sit there. Okay, a 10% hurdle rate in a very an expanding economy is very different from a 10% hurdle rate in a contracting economy. The other part of the problem is here that this is actually a backdoor. First of all, basically this is saying that all projects have the same beta because that would be the only way that they could all have the same discount rate of 10%. That's what that's saying. Even more than that, it's saying that the entire company is being driven, as far as risk is concerned, by some decision that doesn't look like a risk decision. Do you see how by setting the hurdle rate, I will automatically kill off any projects that have returns below a certain value. So as I set the hurdle rate, I am also setting the risk level of projects that we will want. If I set the hurdle rate at 15% or 20%, which I've seen done, that essentially condemns all projects that are safe, low risk, low expected return project. Well, who wants safe, low risk, low return project? Most of the greatest companies on earth were actually in the 20th century and in the 19th century were really unglamorous, unsexy, very low beta companies. That is the reality of it. Yeah, we're going to go for the long ball. We're going to get a really risky couple of projects under our belts, put the money in our pocket, and beer out of here, off to the islands. Yeah, that's not how success actually happens. Madam, do you like candy? I like candy, too. And, I mean, I love that song. I don't know why. It just, anyway, those little, more. Mark, think of the companies that made those, one little candy at a time. And then they got genius. They made the same candy, but they put it in different boxes. Mike and I, now and later, and all that kind of nonsense. And then they had them in the vending machines, the little candies and the little toys and all that. The profit margin on each one was less than a tenth of a cent. But if you make billions and billions of them, you become an empire like the Kraft family. You see the idea? Sometimes, oh, we don't want low-risk projects. We want to go for a hurdle rate of 15, 20%. So all we take are the high-risk, high-expected return projects. Yeah, that's how you usually go out of business very quickly because you get greedy. So these hurdle rates can be used to subvert a better process of asking what risks do we want to take in this company. And do we always want, even if we decide, yes, we're a risky company, do we always want to take on high-risk projects? Or do we also want to take on some low-risk to balance the portfolio of projects? Projects are just like stocks in a company. It's a portfolio that the company creates. Think about this great company now that's half of it's doing really well, the other half sucks.com. Can you think of a company like that? It's run by a complete crazy mofo who in fact dares the SEC to fine him, so they do, and then he tweets, I meant for that to happen. Yeah. Half of his company is very good, is actually surprisingly low risk. The other half is out there, it's one of those things like some idiot who thinks he's going to put colonies on Mars and stuff like that. Sure you are, sure. Yeah. Okay, that's the problem, is that this is a way of subverting an honest discussion of what risks do we want to take on project, on the company as a whole, and on a project-by-project basis. It might be, by the way, it might very well be that you've got an internal rate of return on a project. Let's say a return on investment on a project is 6%. But it might turn out that that project is actually really low risk, and that 6%, most of that is Jensen's Alpha. No one's caught on to this idea for a project yet. That, by the way, and this is the last thing that I'll point out today, is why companies really don't care about what has actually already happened. They're always looking for what's going to happen next. And that's where you're going to find projects, which can be risky, but if you're the one who takes the lead on it, you might make an abnormally high return based upon the risk of the project. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.